Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Geek Tyrant Weekly Podcast. This is episode number 90. We are minus a Bankman tonight. My name is Ben P. I'll be your host for this evening. Joining me is my good friend Mazer. Mazer, how's it going?
Good. You know, it's funny. It was just a couple days ago. I was with Bankman and RP McMurphy, and we're talking about how we've just simplified our names on the site. Bankman used to be Dr. Bankman, and I used to be Root Mazer. And yeah. McMurphy was like, maybe I should just be RP McMurphy was just like, maybe I should just become McMurphy.
Or maybe McMurph.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how you shorten Ben P. That's going to be interesting. But that appears just, to be the pattern that Geek Tyrant users are taking. So
we're just getting lazier and lazier is what it is. It's not anything to do with like intelligence or simplicity. It's just laziness.
It never is on this podcast. joining us also is P. Vader, or potentially upcoming Vader, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know if George Lucas would feel really good about me just being Vader. I think he might come down on me.
The P is just enough to avoid intellectual property theft, basically.
Yeah,
well, just mix it up and just make it Pater.
If he has the copyright for the term droid and he makes whoever manufactures that like pay him royalties, then he might have a problem with me going by Vader.
That's what George Lucas is known for, going after the little people. But so today we're going to talk about a couple things. We'll go through the box office numbers very briefly, and then we'll talk about a couple things that have been mentioned before on this podcast by a couple people, just kind of sporadically, but now everyone, or not everyone, but more people have seen. So we'll go into that in a little bit more detail. We'll talk about The Social Network, as well as Legend of the Guardians, The Owls of Ga'Hoole, and talk about a bunch of comic book movie news that has come out in the past couple of days, including Zack Snyder directing the new Superman movie and more. So let's go ahead and talk about the box office numbers real quick. Number one at the box office this weekend, not really surprising, The Social Network coming in $22.4 million. Number two, Legend of the Guardians, $10 million, $10.8, I guess. So it's kind of a big drop off there. And number three is Wall Street Money Never Sleeps at $10 million. Number four was The Town with $9.7 million. And number five was Easy A with $6.7 million. There's really the month of October, seemingly, to me anyway, does not seem very promising for movie releases. We're kind of in that in-between time between the summer releases and then all of the kind of Oscar-esque movies that are going to be coming out towards the end of the year, as well as some more fun stuff that's coming out in November, like Faster, the new Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie, and you know, some more genre-based stuff like that. But we're kind of in a dead zone as far as movies go right now. So this top five is not surprising to me at all. You guys, do any of these choices surprise you guys?
I might be a little surprised that Let Me In kind of debuted at number eight. It's a little low for what I thought.
That's true, actually. That number eight with 5.1 million.
Yeah.
Mazer, how about you?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm just not aware of marketing anymore, but I don't feel like I saw a few things for it, but I feel like I've seen more marketing for Red, and I feel like I've seen way more marketing for The Social Network.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know if it wasn't pushed enough, or if the people who probably would have seen this have already seen the first film. So
right, yeah, that's a good point. P. Vader, 5 million does seem kind of low for a debut for a movie like that,
for 2,000 something theaters.
Yeah,
how much did they spend to make it?
It says there's a $20 million budget, so it's a relatively low budget movie like that. And you know, with foreign distribution and all that stuff, it'll pretty easily make its money back, I'm guessing. But especially with a genre like a horror genre involving vampires and stuff, that's like a worldwide craze. That's not just an American thing. Everybody's eating that stuff up. So let's go ahead and step into our little time machine that we like to do here on the Geek Tyrant podcast. Go back in time to this week in box office history. This week we'll be talking about, if I'm not mistaken, 2004. This will be the weekend of October 1st through the 3rd in 2004. So it's a little game we like to play where the other people on the panel guess what movies from that year were in the top 10 in this particular weekend, which, again, as we've said, October being kind of a dead zone, this is going to be a little bit more difficult than the summer releases we've been doing over the past couple of months. So with that in mind, do you guys have any guesses for the weekend of October 1st through the 3rd, 2004?
I have no idea.
Go with the one that you were saying earlier, Mazer.
Oh, I was just saying, like, Saw, but I feel like, don't those come out in Halloween? I'm really...
Yep, those are a bit later in the month. There's no Saw movies this early on in October.
I have a guess that's possible.
Okay.
And I did see this in theaters, which is the only reason I may or may not know. I'm going to go with Bernie Mac in Mr. 3000.
Mr. 3000 is correct. That is the number 5 movie in the box office. Mazer, do you have any final guesses before we reveal the top 10?
I don't know. I'm going to take a complete guess, and I'm just going to throw Jackass or Jackass 2, or I don't know.
I'm not seeing any Jackasses here, but that's actually probably something that I would have guessed, to be honest with you, because the year seems about right. So let's just go ahead and tear through the top 10 real quick and move on. Number 1 at the box office, Shark Tale, in its first week with $47.6 million. Number 2, Ladder 49, $22 million.
Totally forgot about that.
Yeah, it's very forgettable. Speaking of forgettable, number 3, The Forgotten, with Julianne Moore, $11.8 million. Number 4, Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, which for some reason I pegged as 2003 in my mind, but whatever. Yeah. That was $3.2 million. Number 5, Mr. 3000, $2.5 million. Number 6, Shaun of the Dead, surprisingly, at $2.4 million. I always consider that more of a kind of a cult classic than a box office one. Number 7, Woman, Thou Art Loosed. I've never heard of that in my life.
Is that a Tyler Perry?
It sounds like a Tyler Perry title. $2.3 million. Number 8, Resident Evil Apocalypse, which kind of blows my mind. That franchise has been around for that long. $2.3 million. Number 9, First Daughter. This is the Katie Holmes movie, not the Mariel Hemingway made for TBS movie. That was $2.1 million. And then number 10, Chris Evans, a.k.a. the future Captain America, rocking it out in Cellular, $2.0 million. So there you have it.
I've never seen Cellular. Is that a good film? I've heard good things about it. I've never actually seen it. Have you guys?
It's fun. It's like a B-movie. It's... I enjoyed it. A lot of people kind of hate it for some reason. I think Alan Trehearne, a writer for the site, kind of despises that movie, but it's also because he really hates William H. Macy, inexplicably. I like William H. Macy, and I like Chris Evans, and I thought the movie was okay. And Jason Statham plays a villain in it, so it can't be that bad. I would say it's worth a rental, probably. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, no.
Yeah,
so.
I think you guys should check it out. You'd probably dig it. It's fairly harmless, so. Let's go ahead and move into our discussion on The Social Network.
I need to do something substantial in order to get the attention of the clubs.
Why?
Because they're exclusive and fun, and they lead to a better life.
People want to go on the internet and check out their friends, so why not build a website that offers that? Friends, pictures, profiles.
I'm talking about taking the entire social experience of college and putting it online.
The site got 2,200 hits within 2 hours.
1,000. 22,000.
This idea is potentially worth millions of dollars.
Millions? You stole our website.
They're saying we stole the Facebook.
I know what it says.
So did we?
$1 million isn't cool. You know what's cool? $1 billion.
You're going to get left behind. It's moving faster than any of us ever imagined.
Get left behind.
Let's sue him in federal court.
I can't wait to stand over your shoulder and watch you write as a check.
If you guys were the inventors of Facebook, you'd have invented Facebook.
Is there anything that you need to tell me?
Your actions could have permanently destroyed everything I've been working on.
We have been working on.
Do you like being a joke? Do you want to go back to that?
Mark!
I talked about this a bit last week, and... You know, I was the only person who's seen it, but now both of you guys have seen it. And Mazer, we were just talking before the podcast started. You saw it twice, so
yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, just tell me what you thought about it.
You know, I think it's one of those films. I read the book. It's loosely based. Well, kind of. It's based on this book called The Accidental Billionaires. And I can see all the stuff they pulled out of it. But it's pretty interesting. The script was very, very – it was a pretty sizable script, and it looked like it was going to be a pretty long film. And, I mean, they got it down to a two-hour film, and that is a credit to the directing and the acting and just the construction of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's completely efficient. I think if you're an editor, this is a film to study. If you're a director, this is a film study. If you're a writer, this is a film study. It's just one of those films that's going to be in film classes and probably more, because it's probably more currently relevant than, say, Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
And it's easier to draw those parallels, and it'll probably be compared and studied in together and all those types of things.
Yeah.
I love the film. I would say, because I happen to have read tons of articles when all this stuff was happening from, 2004 on, movie is a work of fiction. So even if it's only half true, it's still a lot of fun. Probably my favorite David Fincher film. Probably my favorite thing that Aaron Sorkin has ever done. I've got to say, having watched it two times, the first time at midnight and the second time a few days later, the score is probably my favorite score of any film. I think we talked
wow.
about
ever.
I think ever.
Wow! Holy crap! That is a ridiculous praise.
I think it. And it works so well in the editing that it's almost too well. It's almost too good. You know what I mean? It's like there's if you shoot a music video, you edit to the music, mm-hmm. but it's somehow the music and the editing have such harmony that it's just so perfect. Like the music is able to change gears. And it makes the editing change its style, and it brings the audience with it. And when I watched it first, I was just kind of, wow, this is just flowing. And then the second time I watched it, I go, wow, all these little cues are coming up where a normal audience would just feel like these are abrupt things. But the music helps carry you along without making the editing feel schizophrenic.
Yeah.
Although I've heard from some people that it is, they can't follow all the multiple storylines happening concurrently.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's almost always like two things happening at the same time, and sometimes four things happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think at the climax, I don't say the climax, but when you really get to see this film go into full gear, you have blogging, code making, you have a party going on, and then once the thing starts to go, it gets released, Face Mash, you get to see like three things happening and up to four things happening almost at the same time. And there's so many layers, and there's a lot of things where you just have a little scene with a character, and it's probably 5 seconds, but it's so impactful.
Yeah. And then not only those scenes that you're talking about, but they're also intercut back and forth with not one, but two different court cases that are going on at the same time. So you never know which one of those you're going to suddenly be thrown back into, and kind of what yeah. context is there as well. So yeah, layering this is layering on a different level than Inception, but just as effective, I would say.
Yeah. Just the subtle use of camera work and coloring to kind of give you hints of whose perspective you're almost hearing the story from it's one of those things that like the more you watch it, the more you're going to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, Pivet, what'd you think?
I think, I definitely enjoyed the film. I'm not sure I'm going to come down on the side of the fence as high of, with this high of critical praise, I guess, as, as Mazur and I read Venkman's and Ben P's review. But yeah, it's definitely enjoyable. You know, well written, definitely. I would say my favorite part is kind of, yeah, it's kind of along the lines of what Mazur's kind of getting at along the technical side. I really enjoyed how they kind of lit the movie and the coloring of it, I guess you would call it. The Harvard campus, I assume that's the real Harvard campus. I felt like if I went to Harvard, that's what the campus would look like at night, or that's how I would want the campus to look like at night, you know?
Yeah.
And how they look.
Even though there's parts of it which are completely not, and they've done a really good job.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesse Eisenberg does a pretty good job. I think Venkman said it earlier where Mark Zuckerberg may not like how he's portrayed in this movie. Because, I mean, Mazur, you kind of hinted at it. It's, you know, even if it's half true, I'm not sure people are going to, everyone's going to realize that, you know. So I guess you got to go into the movie with a little grain of salt. But other than that, it's a pretty good movie, and definitely got to see that movie if you haven't.
Yeah. That's a lot. That's one of the big issues that's being brought up about the movie. There's two things that people are talking about now that the initial kind of opening weekend buzz has died down a bit. People are talking about, one, what you're just saying, where, how do you want to word that? Like, what's the
perception versus?
Yeah, kind of like the fact that these are real people that the film depicts, you know, and they're actually still working. And
it's recent events.
And too. Yeah, it's very recent. And the way that the general audience is going to look at this movie is going to affect their perception of these real people, regardless of how true these actual events were, depicted in this film. Because Sorkin has said a couple times that it's fictionalized. And Mazur, you read the book that it's based off of. You read the book, and the book was, you know, pitched to Ben Mezrich by Eduardo, the character played by Andrew Garfield in the movie. And so it's clearly, you know, kind of more aligned to his point of view. So there's that aspect, and then removed and filtered again through Aaron Sorkin. So it's like, we really don't know exactly how much of this is real. But it does kind of affect these real people and their real lives, you know? So it's a lot of the movie itself doesn't go out of its way to explain all those concessions that I've just listed, basically. A lot of movies just slap the kind of based on a true story tag on there, and you just assume that it's true, and or, you know, to some degree. And this one, I feel like, went through a couple extra layers of filtering that it should have said something about it, maybe, or should have been a bit more clear as to the fact that, hey, you can't take these actual events as, you know, the gospel truth. But so that's like one of the things that people are talking about. And the second one is the movie's depiction of women as being nothing more than like objects of desire or stupid sluts or just completely useless overall, which the argument that I've read against that, which I tend to kind of agree with, is that the movie is told from the guy's point of view, and to them that's kind of like the women in this movie are completely secondary to the actual story that's taking place. So Devin Faraci from Chud wrote on his Twitter, like, if the Facebook was about women, it would have been about women or something like that, you know, using kind of repurposing the line that that Zuckerberg actually said in the movie, where it's like, if you invaded Facebook, then you would have invaded Facebook.
Yeah.
So, some people are taking those arguments a bit too far, I think. But anyway, those are just kind of two things that people are talking about right now after the movie. But Mazur, you bring up an interesting point with the score. I remember liking it a lot when I watched it, but I haven't had the benefit of seeing it for the second time. And I think seeing it again will definitely, because the dialogue is so rapid fire and you're so like immersed in the world that Fincher and Sorkin have kind of combined to create, I didn't really have a lot of time to to separate myself and look at more of the technical aspects of the movie. I was so kind of hooked into the story the first time watching it. So I'll definitely be interested to watch it again, knowing what happens, you know, and not that we already didn't know what was happening, spoiler for real life, you know, but and seeing those kinds of aspects kind of brought to the forefront a little bit more on multiple viewings.
Yeah, it underlines everything perfectly, and you get the feeling of energy shifts on screen and all sorts of stuff, and it's just the second time around, because you're just the first time you're just trying to keep up.
Yeah,
it's so like there's no lulls. If you've got to go to the bathroom 5 minutes in, well, too bad.
Yeah.
There's no scene you can go. That pee app on your iPhone that says you can safely leave at this moment, it's not going to give you anything, because there's no good time to leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would be interested to see what that had to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would probably say right after that opening scene during the opening credits where Zuckerberg is walking across the Harvard campus. That's the only time, because he's just walking across the campus. And even that is just like some gorgeous cinematography that I wouldn't want to miss out on. But this is a really, really solid movie. As Vader said, or P. Vader, excuse me.
Oh, he's
Lucas,
doing it.
As Vader said, definitely check this one out if you haven't seen it yet.
Something I would say that was I enjoyed several of the performances, but obviously we had seen Jesse Eisenberg do a few films and do really great, but he had been compared to like being a poor man's
Michael Cera.
Michael Cera.
Yeah.
Which it's sad that he was pigeonholed in that way. But he completely steps out in a completely different direction, and you kind of realize he's at a different caliber. He was probably doing Michael Cera because that's what they wanted him to do, and he did it perfectly. And I think he could probably transform into practically anyone at this point, but we'll see. But it is just an amazing performance that holds the whole film together.
Yeah, he was really great, and he was almost like borderline Aspergian with like his lack of social norms and just like the way that he didn't really understand the way that the world worked in that way. And I think that was like that's a big part of his performance, is making us believe that that's the way that Zuckerberg thought, and that's kind of probably a main reason why Facebook even exists, and the way that these kind of entrepreneurs think sometimes is like they don't think like everybody else, so it gives them the capacity to think outside the box, you know. And I think his performance is really, really exceptional. He did a great job. Actually, all the performances in this movie were really great. I talked last time about Andrew Garfield kind of jumping from, you know, movie to movie to movie and completely disappearing in these roles. I think Eisenberg definitely took a big step out of that Michael Cera shadow, and Timberlake was really good as well. Rooney Mara had, you know, a super small role.
But you know what? In the small little bit that you see her in, you're like, her impact to the Zuckerberg character is felt through the whole film, especially watching it a second time.
Yeah.
You realize how much she's done in the few seconds or minutes that she's on screen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she kind of breaks him down mentally, and that's the kind of catalyst for the entire thing, basically. That she's his rosebud, that's for sure. So
also a great performance by Armie Hammer.
Oh man, was that not amazing? Like,
it was freaky. McMurphy did not know that he was doing both performances. He thought it was just twins.
Yeah, I didn't either when I first saw it. Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, and then when you go, wait, really? It's amazing. I knew it going in, and I was looking for it. And, there's been a lot of movies where you have actors acting against themselves. And it is really, really hard to make those interactions feel natural. And I think it's probably more a credit to the director than the actor. I mean, obviously the actor is important, but actors are usually acting against another actor in a one shot, and then they have to kind of recreate that experience again. So doing that on screen for a split seems like it wouldn't be much different than doing another camera angle. Yeah. But it's the editor, it's the director and the editor working together to make those feel like there's actual interaction. And it's weird because they have all these beats where it's like they have, I don't know if they shot what they shot first, if they had like cues at certain times for when interactions were going to happen, but like they interact, they have like back and forth and there's like banter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on the same, like, it's really interesting. So
yeah, when I saw it, I saw in the end credits that it said Armie Hammer played both of the Winklevoss twins. And then I went home and looked on IMDb, and it said that one of them was played by an actor named Josh Pence, who I'd never heard of before. And I was like, wait, what? IMDb is very rarely wrong when it comes to that stuff. So I was like, what's going on here? And then I found out afterward, I watched an interview with Armie Hammer where he said that Josh Pence was like the body for one of the Winklevoss twins when Armie Hammer was actually acting. And then they redid it and then just used the kind of Benjamin Button technology to graft his face onto the other guy's body for the performances when they were like physically, you know, touching each other or, you know, in such a tight spot like that. For one shot and stuff, obviously he would physically play both of the parts, but they didn't do it the way that I thought that they would do it, which is like ridiculously complicated the way that I thought they would do it, where like they would somehow stitch the frames together, you know, with moving shots and everything. That's why I was just like kind of marveling at how ridiculous that was, but it's not, I don't think that's even possible for them to do that. So they didn't do it that way. They had Josh Pence actually, you know, in there with Armie Hammer doing it, and then they just kind of grafted Hammer's face onto the second body. So that removed just a tiny bit of the mystery of how they did that, but it still adds a whole nother level of like technical complexity to that that performance, as well as, like Mazer was saying, the directorial capability to pull something like that off, as well as, you know, effects and all that. This movie is just it's pretty stellar, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So Mazer, you got a chance to see Legend of the Guardians, right? Very recently.
Yeah, I saw it under the recommendation of Venkman and a 10-year-old. So
nice.
I said those are trusted opinions.
Yeah,
those are my circle.
Venkman and a 10-year-old. That's it. That's all you need. So yeah, I had a chance to check it out as well, and because Venkman spoke so highly of it, I was like, all right, I'm giving this thing a shot.
Legend tells of a band of noble warriors known as the Guardians of Ga'Hoole. Whenever trouble is at hand, seek them out, for they are sworn to protect the innocent and vanquish evil. Should I stop?
What?
No.
Oh, this is my favorite part!
Next.
Then Lai strikes the final blow.
The Guardians win. La 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 la. They go home. The end. Think about something real.
They're real.
What did you think about Legend of the Guardians?
So it's obviously a kid's story, right?
Yeah.
It's based on kid's book. Beautiful, beautiful. Like the animation is amazing. Like you look at it and like every single feather is like rendered in sharp detail with like shadows and everything. It's like, it's mind boggling if you just stare at a single shot of it. But
yeah, it reminded me of kind of like Aslan from the Chronicles of Narnia movie from Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe, how that kind of the lion's fur and all that stuff looked so real when that movie came out. It's kind of like that, but on crack, I thought.
Yeah, it's like it just gets right past that uncanny valley, and it just nails it as being completely believable of like real owls talking and all sorts of stuff. I like the story. I feel like maybe my imagination hyped up the action a bit more than I was expecting. It was still really, really cool.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I was imagining it being, or maybe I just have, I don't know, from too many video games. My imagination seemed like it would be a bigger battle. But I don't know. What was your feeling of the battle at the end?
Yeah, I think it built slowly to that, and then I wasn't disappointed with it.
No, definitely not.
I was kind of expecting more, quote-unquote, action throughout, and then it really kind of built to this final thing. And, you know, I wrote a review of it, and I kind of compared it a little bit to How to Train Your Dragon. The story, in my opinion, pulls from a bunch of different places, and it's, from what I understand, the story is the compilation of the first three books in the series. So, I don't know. It kind of feels like that, if you know what I mean. Like, it feels a bit stitched together, a bit incomplete, and kind of lowest common denominator. But that's because it's aimed at kids, and maybe I'm just being spoiled watching really, really great family movies that have come out of the past couple of years that Pixar's put out, and How to Train Your Dragon and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and a lot of these movies that I've really, really enjoyed. This one just felt like one notch below that as far as the story, in my opinion. I thought the battle was really cool. The action, you know, it's very clearly a Zack Snyder movie. When Venkman was mentioning this in one of the last episode, I think, he was talking about how Snyder uses the slow-mo time-shifting or speed-ramping stuff. And I was like, really? Like, he does that with the owls? But that actually turned out to be some of the coolest parts in the whole movie. Didn't you think so, Mazer?
I think so. Actually, I think it's completely necessary in a film like this, because when you have these, it's so fast that, because you have them fighting plus they're flying. So if you aren't able to slow it down, it would just be kind of a blurry mess and you wouldn't be able to engage with it.
Yeah.
And I think it was necessary for you to have the speed ramping so you could actually just catch the details and figure out what's going on. Otherwise, you'd be completely lost.
I thought the voice work was pretty good too. I for some reason, the entire movie was going through thinking that Orlando Bloom was in it. And he wasn't at all. I thought the lead guy was played by Orlando Bloom, and I'm pretty sure it was Jim Sturgess, who was in 21 and Across the Universe. But I just kept, like, because I went in with almost no knowledge, I watched the trailer when it first came out one time, and that's it. Like, I'd seen no TV spots or anything, and then just heard Venkman kind of rave about it. I was like, okay, I'll go check this out. I knew almost nothing about it. So I didn't know who was in it or anything like that. So I spent a lot of the movie trying to figure out who all the voices were. And they all did really great. I mean, there's like Jeffrey Rush, Helen Mirren, a lot of kind of high quality people in there. So I don't know. Would you recommend seeing this, Mazer? What do you think?
Yeah, I would have to be selective to the person.
Yeah.
My thing would be like, do you like? I think the biggest thing is, can you get past the talking owls? If you can get past that, I think for most people, then you're good. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you have kids, definitely check it out. I would say if you're a fan of some of those other animated films that we've been talking about,
if you read the book, then you're probably gonna, from what I understand, it does the books justice. So.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I don't really know. I haven't read the books, but yeah, the animation, I mean, really kind of staggering.
Yeah, I would be happy to watch, you know, two or three more of these.
Yeah,
if they're in the same quality and keep it interesting.
Yeah, I think Venkman said it last week that you can basically take any frame of this movie and just like pause it and use it as like a screensaver or a background or something. And I absolutely agree with that. It's just gorgeous all the way through.
It's amazing. It's not like quite painterly, and it's not quite fully photoreal. It's just got a beautiful quality to it that all the details just come out at you in a way that you don't see in other CG animated films.
Yeah. Cool. Well, okay, let's go ahead and move on into some of the geek news this week. The huge one, the bomb that dropped this week that shook the internet to its core, is that Zack Snyder, the director of Legend of the Guardians, has been announced that he's directing the new Superman movie. This is the one that's being produced by Chris Nolan and kind of godfathered, whatever that may end up meaning. But gut reactions, you guys, what do you think about Zack Snyder directing Superman, P. Vader, go?
I'm not entirely sold on it. I will say that. I think they could have done a lot worse. The films that I've seen of Zack Snyder's, I've only seen 300 and Watchmen. He definitely has his own touch that he brings. He can put them in their own world. He definitely does a good job with blue screens or green screens, whichever one they use for that stuff. I guess you guys would be able to answer this better. Having the only two movies I've seen of Zack Snyder's have been both rated R movies, and I just don't know if he'd be able to tone it down for a PG-13 movie. I'm assuming that's what the Superman's going to be.
Yeah, that's a good assumption.
But I do think he can pull it off, and I'm not rooting against him by any means. I will be interested to see what the final product is.
Mazer, how about you?
I love Superman. I'm probably not as much as I love Batman, because I feel like it's more relatable to most people, well, and myself especially. But
are you saying you're like a billionaire, like vigilante, basically?
Yes.
Okay.
But something about Superman, he's Superman, right? He's awesome, but the idea of this guy who can pretty much do anything, yet he still has problems, to me, I always thought was pretty interesting. But just being a symbol of hope and all those other types of, like, the mythology of it, of, like, Krypton kind of being like, I don't know, kind of being like, like a destroyed Mount Olympus, and you've got the son of like God. It's like just there's so many things tied into it that you could really get really you could go crazy trying to find all the things you could tie it to. I think just I love the Richard Donner films, and there's a lot of heart in those films. The first one, and I don't know if Zack Snyder can do just beautiful stuff that is really amazing, but I don't know if he has the ability to put a soul into this Superman. I feel like all of his work so far has, while very good and very strong, been amazingly superficial in how it's executed.
I think his work has been almost that was the big problem with Watchmen that I think a lot of people experienced, that it was too close to the subject material, you know, too similar to Alan Moore's graphic novel. And then, you know, I read the book, the graphic novel for 300, and it's almost, you know, they use that as the kind of quote-unquote Bible on the set of that movie, and it's very obvious that that's what happened. So it's almost shot for shot sometimes based on Frank Miller's book. So the thing with Superman, I'm kind of right there with you, Mazer, as far as Snyder being able to, like, having a couple doubts about whether he can infuse the movie with the heart that's absolutely necessary for a Superman story. But my expectations are raised a bit with the involvement of Chris Nolan. I think he's the one who is going to be able to kind of use Zack Snyder as a tool, and he's really going to be the kind of guiding force, or what I'm hoping anyway, is that he's going to be the guiding force behind this movie and just use Snyder as this kind of visual master that he kind of is, and just be able to use him as a tool, almost as like looking at Nolan as the editor and just having him kind of sitting back and shaping this entire movie from the get-go. So, you know, he's the one who's been kind of who essentially pitched the idea to David Goyer all those years ago. And Goyer, you know, obviously worked with Nolan on Batman Begins and Dark Knight, and he's responsible for writing this new adaptation. They say he's got a really good take on how to make it kind of modern and relevant and stuff. And I think that's where Chris Nolan's really going to be able to come in and take the story and kind of make it what it needs to be. And then just kind of let like step back and let loose and then let Zack Snyder kind of do his thing with it. And I think that's going to be a really, really interesting combination when all is said and done, because these guys are very different filmmakers, but they're both really, really great at what they do individually. So seeing them team up is going to be, it could be something really special. I don't know. I'm not going to go as far as to say that, you know, that I have like massively high expectations or anything. But if Zack Snyder knows how to do anything, it's how to make a movie look cool. That's like a great talent that he has. And even in Legend of the Guardians, we saw that. You know, so it doesn't matter what the subject matter is. The guy knows how to make stuff look freaking cool on screen. So that the look of the movie, I think, is not an issue for me. It's the only thing is like whether or not the story is going to live up to kind of our expectations and whether or not Chris Nolan's going to be able to form, you know, that into something that everybody is hoping that it's going to be.
I think we're with Zack Snyder, we're going to finally see Superman do some amazing things that we've been hoping to see a Superman film.
Yeah.
And I think it's mostly just because the limitations of the technology at the time when the films were made.
Yeah.
Or the limitations of nostalgia in the last one.
Right.
I've got to wait and see. But I'm excited about the supposedly leaked concept of what this first Superman film is going to be about.
What was that again? What's the log line there? Do you remember?
So it's basically Superman. Well, it's Clark Kent. He's a reporter who is traveling the world to decide whether if he's basically going to use his powers, if he's going to be Superman.
Okay. Yeah, that seems almost getting into like Smallville territory a bit, like kind of a quasi origin story without the Krypton part, which, you know, could be interesting because Smallville has made it relatively interesting for probably at least 4 seasons out of the 10 that they've been going, but enough digs at that show. There's also this report that came out that says that Zack Snyder was actually not Warner Brothers' first choice as the director because Goyer's script was kind of rushed and is still a little bit of a mess, they say. And Warner Brothers really wanted somebody who can kind of get in there, like fire out a draft, kind of maybe rewrite the script, kind of punch it up a bit, and then get it going because they really don't have a lot of time to work with here. The movie has to be in production by 2011, or maybe I'm not exactly sure what that means, whether that means by the end of 2010 or at some point in 2011, the cameras actually have to start rolling. I think that the latter is probably true. But they have to do that by law, basically, because there's all this litigation from the heirs of Siegel and Shuster, who are the creators of Superman. And Warner Brothers only has a certain amount of time where they can make the next movie, and then they'll kind of spend the next few years in court worrying about rights and all that stuff, and who knows what's going to happen after that. But they know for a fact that they can make one more if they get production moving quickly. So that's why they actually hired Snyder. From what I understand, Ben Affleck was Chris Nolan's first choice. That's what a report said a week or two ago. So that would have been interesting also. And then Darren Aronofsky was in the running as well, but Aronofsky is kind of notorious for wanting a lot of creative control over his material and taking a long time to develop projects and stuff. And time is just something that Warner Brothers doesn't have at this point. So that's why they got Snyder. Plus the fact that Snyder's a really great asset for Warner Brothers. He's done almost all of his movies, if not all of them there. And he's kind of proven himself as one of the studio's top directors right now. So it's a good pairing, I think. I don't think we should be so worried about, you know, Venkman wrote up this story about the kind of rush script and stuff, and he says that his faith in the project is dwindling a little bit. It's never a good thing when a studio rushes a film into production. I think, you know, he's right, generally speaking. In this case, I don't really think we have a lot to worry about. I think it really is Nolan that's just kind of holding my faith in this project right now. If he wasn't involved, I might be a bit more inclined to be worried about this project, but I think it's in really good hands. So, yeah, we'll just we'll have to wait and see. The thing that I was thinking the entire time of watching Legend of the Guardians is, like, because I went and saw the movie right after this announcement was made, so I was watching it with that kind of idea of Zack Snyder directing Superman in mind. And there's a bunch of flight scenes in Legend of the Guardians, and I was like, well, at least this is a test reel, like a demo reel for what flight footage could look like. And Legend of the Guardians, I saw it in 3D. And there's been no announcement so far whether or not...
I'm going to reference Aviator in that, you know, when you have no clouds or anything, they had to reshoot it because you had no sense of speed of the airplanes. And you definitely have a sense of speed and of all the elements in Guardians of Ga'Hoole. So he definitely understands what it takes to make people feel like... you know, something's traveling through the air very quickly.
Yeah, and you know, watching Legend of the Guardians in 3D, and there's been no announcement whether or not the Superman movie's going to be in 3D. I'm guessing it probably will be, just because that's the trend recently, and Warner Brothers is probably going to want to make as much money off of this one as possible in case their litigation doesn't go through. So that's just kind of a cynical guess on my part. But
I want to see Superman in 3D.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I saw... Superman Returns in 3D, and some of those sequences were kind of cool. So, like, the plane sequence and stuff, I think only a select part of that movie was actually shown in 3D at the time. This was back in, '06.
So. Yeah, because it was, like, the conversion process, and it was, like, one of the first early ones that they did.
Yeah.
So.
But, yeah, I mean, basically what I'm saying is Legend of the Guardians gives me confidence that Zack Snyder can pull off 3D, so I don't think that's going to be an issue. You know, as long as they plan to shoot the movie in 3D, which I hope they'll make that decision.
And he's a smart enough director to know that he would have to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, you know, it's one of those things where it's like it's maybe a lot about who they have as Superman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's been some more speculation about John Hamm possibly getting the role because Hamm worked with Zack Snyder on Sucker Punch, which is coming out in March. So that's nothing more than speculation. That's nothing more than, like, the Natalie Portman maybe being Lois Lane rumors when Aronofsky was in consideration for the director's chair. So, you know, we'll be talking about that Garen freaking Teed when that news is announced. So we'll be ripping that to part to shreds as soon as that news arrives. So let's go ahead and move on. We'll talk a little bit about Emma Stone. She, being the star of Easy A, the number 5 movie in America this week, and one that Mazur quite liked a couple weeks ago.
Give it a chance, guys.
Yeah, she's been given the role of Gwen Stacy in Mark Webb's new Spider-Man movie. This one definitely is going to be in 3D. They announced that a while ago. And... you know, this kind of took people by surprise because she was Deadline or somebody had a report a couple days beforehand that she was in contention for the role of Mary Jane Watson. And then all of a sudden, just like a couple days later, it was announced that she actually won the role of Gwen Stacy. So Gwen Stacy is supposed to be the big love interest for the first movie and maybe on into the other ones. And apparently Mary Jane doesn't even play into the first movie at all. So,
which is completely confusing to me because... you know, knowing Mary Jane Watson from the comic books and how she's been imagined several times, Emma Stone is Mary Jane Watson. I don't see who they would get better than her.
Yeah.
That kind of bothered me a little bit. I felt when I heard that she was rumors to play Mary Jane Watson, I was just like, oh man, that just seems too easy. You know, like, let's go, like, one step beyond what our first instinct would be and maybe, like, think of somebody else. So when I heard that she was going to play Gwen Stacy, that made me feel a little bit better. because A, you know, they are going beyond their first instinct and looking for someone else for Mary Jane. And then B, I actually can see Emma Stone, you know, assuming that her natural hair color apparently is blonde.
Yeah.
I can see her playing Gwen Stacy more so, or I guess I like her playing Gwen Stacy more than I do Mary Jane. So I'm kind of excited about the casting, if not just to see what Emma Stone looks like as a blonde.
Yeah. yeah, my knowledge of Gwen Stacy comes exclusively from Bryce Dallas Howard in Spider-Man 3, which she was kind of a small role in that movie, and then Spider-Man the Animated Series that ran in the 90s. And so, I don't know. It's been a while since I've seen those Spider-Man episodes, but I don't know. For me, man, what little I know of Emma Stone from, because I still haven't seen Izzy A, but from what little I know of her, I think she was kind of a dead ringer for Mary Jane. But I appreciate what you're saying about wanting them to go the extra level, and I have respect for them for doing that, and I definitely respect that point of view. So hopefully she'll – I mean, she's a good actress. She'll do fine.
Yeah.
That's not going to be an issue. It's just going to be interesting to see who they get as Mary Jane, because that's the part where I'm, like, still a bit hung up on them probably not finding anybody better than Emma Stone to take on the role of Mary Jane.
Well, this is my thing. I've been throwing out the crazy idea of her being Gwen Stacy – Gwen Stacy dies, and then he meets Mary Jane Watson, who's also played by Emma Stone.
Did you not say that to P. Vader? I think you told me that right before we started recording.
No,
did you not say that?
No, I didn't say that.
I said it.
Yeah, that was.
Oh, you
amazing.
Said it before we started recording?
I said it, and I'm just repeating it on the podcast.
Okay. All right, right on. No, I knew I heard that somewhere before.
Yeah, yeah, and I was like, well, that would be kind of a crazy idea. My favorite film is Joe versus the Volcano. For romantic comedies,
mm-hmm.
and Meg Ryan plays, I think, at least three or four women in that movie, including the love interest.
I like the balls on that decision there, Mazer. I think you should go up to Sony and kick down the door and pitch that idea to them.
Unless Emma Stone could pull an army hammer and. Play both Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane Watson at the same time.
On the screen at the same time.
Yes.
Wow. That would be amazing.
and have enough of an adjustment in her physical performance that it would confuse people. And they go, wow, they look really alike. those two actresses.
That would be awesome. Okay, so let's talk about the last thing here. Apparently, Kathryn Bigelow is working on or getting ready to start work on her new movie called Triple Frontier, which is the drama that is going to be about organized crime that is kind of on the border between Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil. And it's her follow-up to The Hurt Locker. So everybody's kind of closely following this project, seeing what's going on. Mark Boll, who's the guy who wrote The Hurt Locker, is also writing this project. So they're kind of working together again. The really big announcement is that both Johnny Depp and Tom Hanks are in talks to join the cast of this movie, which, I mean, you know, where are you going to find a pairing like this? The most recent thing I can think of is The Tourist, which is the Johnny Depp, Angelina Jolie movie, just because Johnny Depp is in it. But, you know, like really huge A-list actors teaming up with a director like this that just came off of huge wins at the Oscars for, I think, Best Screenplay and Best Picture. So probably more. I know The Hurt Locker won more awards than that. I just don't remember what they are right now. But, I mean, what do you guys think about this, the potential of Depp and Tom Hanks working together?
You know, they haven't ever been in a movie together, right?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
My brain is boggled by it, I gotta
really?
Say. Yeah. There's such different types of acting styles.
Yeah, and especially in something like the movie being set in this kind of, like organized crime stuff. It's supposed to be kind of gritty and maybe, I'm guessing, at least have a foot in the action genre to some degree. Seeing Tom Hanks in that kind of role, to me, it just kind of doesn't seem right. I'm still used to seeing him in comedies for some reason. Like, even though he's obviously done a lot with his career, and especially with movies like Castaway and Saving Private Ryan and stuff, where he's gotten pretty far away from comedy. I don't know, maybe it's just been too long, but I've never really seen him outside of Road to Perdition in a role that sounds, you know, as kind of morally ambiguous as this.
I'm kind of interested to see just the kind of dynamic between these two guys, basically because of what you just said, Mazur, that they're differing acting styles. So I think that alone would compel me to see this movie, just because, like, you very rarely get so such actors at the top of their game working in the same movie.
Yeah, let alone the involvement of Kathryn Bigelow and Mark Wahl. So
yeah,
I tried to think of an odder pairing in a film that just had completely. The only thing I could think of was like Tracy Morgan and Bruce Willis in Cop Out as something that just was just like, what?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense. That's wrong. It's very wrong.
Oh, man.
Oh, I thought you were about to come up with like a fictional pairing, like
no.
Tracy Morgan and Michael Caine or something like that.
Yeah, that could actually work. Michael Caine is pretty funny.
That would be awesome. No, I can't get that out of my head. All right, cool. Well, coming soon, we're recording this podcast on Thursday, October 7th. So coming out tomorrow, not much. Life as We Know It, the dreadful-looking Katherine Heigl movie, is coming out. Apparently Secretariat is going to be released, that horse movie that nobody gives a crap about. And I Spit on Your Grave, unrated, for like the horror people who love watching rape on screen. So there's really it's kind of a dreadful weekend for film, I think. You know, the weekend after that, you got a couple borderline interesting things with Jackass 3D and Red. So P. Vader and I saw a screening of Red the other day, so we'll definitely talk about that next week. But I think that'll pretty much wrap it up. So if you guys want, you can go subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. It's free. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/geektyrantfans. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/geektyrant. You can check out the store we've got at geektyrant.me, and they've got, you know, t-shirts and glasses and all that stuff. We're getting ready to throw up some 3D glasses on there sometime soon. And if you like what you hear and you like what you read on the site, feel free to donate at geektyrant.com/donate. Your donations help keep us doing what we're doing, so we appreciate it. I think that's pretty much going to be it. Mazur, thanks for joining, as always.
Yes.
And
I tried to give a longer, you know, awkward pause in that.
That's all we need. That's all we need.
It takes a lot of nerve. I can't do the Andy Kaufman thing. It's hard.
Yeah, it turns into like a William Shatner performance piece if you go any longer pauses than that. But P. Vader, thanks for joining as well.
You're welcome.
We'll have to get Venkman back next time and get into the regular groove of things. But thanks for listening, guys, and we will talk to you all next week.